Forthwith, the world empire he had snatched at and held in his hands, as a child might snatch at and hold a precious vase, fell to the ground and was shattered to pieces. Whatever appearance of a worldwide order may have gleamed upon men's imaginations vanished at his death. The story becomes a story of a barbaric autocracy in confusion. Everywhere the provincial rulers set up for themselves. In the course of a few years, the entire family of Alexander had been destroyed. Roxana, his barbarian wife, was prompt to murder, as a rival, the daughter of Darius. She herself presently bore Alexander a posthumous son, who was also called Alexander. He was murdered with her a few years later, 311 BC. Hercules, the only other son of Alexander, was murdered also. So too was Aridaeus, the weak-minded half-brother. Plutarch gives a last glimpse of Olympias during a brief interval of power in Macedonia, accusing first this person and then that of poisoning her wonderful son. Many she killed in her fury. The bodies of some of his circle who had died after his death she caused to be dug up, but we don't know if any fresh light was shed upon his death by these disinterments. Finally, Olympias was killed in Macedonia by the friends of those she had slain. Sixth. From this welter of crime, there presently emerged three leading figures. Much of the old Persian Empire, as far as the Indus eastward and almost Lydia in the west, was held by one general Seleucus, who founded a dynasty, the Seleucid dynasty. Macedonia fell to another Macedonian general, Antigonus. A third Macedonian, Ptolemy, secured Egypt, and, making Alexandria his chief city, established a sufficient naval ascendancy to keep also Cyprus and most of the coast of Phoenicia and Asia Minor. The Ptolemaic and Seleucid empires lasted for a considerable time. The forms of government in Asia Minor and the Balkans were more unstable. Two maps will help the reader to a sense of the kaleidoscopic nature of the political boundaries of the 3rd century BC. Antigonus was defeated and killed at the Battle of Ipsus in 301, leaving Lysimachus, the governor of Thrace, and Cassander of Macedonia and Greece as equally transitory successors. Minor governors carved out smaller states. Meanwhile, the barbarians swung down into the broken-up and enfeebled world of civilization from the west and from the east. From the west came the Gauls, a people closely related to the Celts. They raided down through Macedonia and Greece to Delphi, and 227 BC two sections of them crossed the Bosphorus into Asia Minor, being first employed as mercenaries and then setting up for themselves as independent plunderers. And after raiding almost to Taurus, they settled in the old Phrygian land, holding the people about them to tribute. These Gauls of Phrygia became the Galatians of St. Paul's epistle. Armenia and the southern shores of the Black Sea became a confusion of changing rulers. Kings with Hellenistic ideas appeared in Cappadocia, in Pontus, the south shore of the Black Sea, in Bithynia, and in Pergamum. From the east, the Scythians and the Parthians and Bactrians also drove southward. For a time, there were Greek-ruled Bactrian states becoming more and more orientalized. In the 2nd century BC, Greek adventurers from Bactria raided down into North India and founded short-lived kingdoms there, the last eastward fling of the Greek. Then, gradually, barbarism fell again, like a curtain, between the Western civilizations and India. Seventh. Amidst all these shattered fragments of the burst bubble of Hellenic empire, one small state stands out and demands at least a brief section to itself, the Kingdom of Pergamum. We hear first of this town as an independent center during the struggle that ended in the Battle of Ipsus. While the tide of the Gaulish invasion swirled and foamed to and fro about Asia Minor between the years 277 and 241, Pergamum, for a time, paid them tribute. But she retained her general independence, and at last, under Attalus I, refused her tribute and defeated them in two decisive battles. For more than a century thereafter, until 133 BC, Pergamum remained free, and was perhaps during that period the most highly civilized state in the world. on the hill of the Acropolis was reared a rich group of buildings, palaces, temples, a museum, and a library, rivals of those of Alexandria, of which we shall presently tell, and almost the first in the world. Under the princes of Pergamum, Greek art blossomed afresh, and the reliefs of the altar of the Temple of Zeus and the statues of the fighting and dying Gauls which were made there are among the great artistic treasures of mankind. In a little while, as we shall tell later, the influence of a new power began to be felt in the eastern Mediterranean, the power of the Roman Republic, friendly to Greece and to Greek civilization. And in this power, the Hellenic communities of Pergamum and Rhodes found a natural and useful ally and supporter against the Galatians and against the orientalized Seleucid Empire. We shall relate how at last the Roman power came into Asia, how it defeated the Seleucid Empire at the Battle of Magnesia in 190, and drove it out of Asia Minor and beyond the Taurus Mountains, and how finally, in 133 BC, Attalus III, the last king of Pergamum, bowing to his sense of an inevitable destiny, made the Roman Republic the heir to his kingdom, which became then the Roman province of Asia. 8. Nearly all historians are disposed to regard the career of Alexander the Great as marking an epoch in human affairs. It drew together all the known world, excepting only the Western Mediterranean, into one drama. But the opinions men have formed of Alexander himself vary enormously. They fall, most of them, into two main schools. One type of scholar is fascinated by the youth and splendor of this young man. These Alexander worshippers seem disposed to take him at his own valuation, to condone every crime and folly, either as the mere ebullience of a rich nature, or as the bitter necessity to some gigantic scheme, and to regard his life as framed upon a design, a scheme of statesmanship, such as all the wider knowledge and wider ideas of these later times barely suffice to bring into the scope of our understanding. On the other hand, there are those who see him only as a wrecker of the slowly maturing possibilities of a free and tranquil Hellenized world. Before we ascribe to Alexander or to his father Philip schemes of world policy, such as a 20th-century historian-philosopher might approve, we'll do well to consider very carefully the utmost range of knowledge and thought that was possible in those days. The world of Plato, Isocrates, and Aristotle had practically no historical perspective at all. There hadn't been such a thing as history in the world. History, that is, as distinguished from mere priestly chronicles, until the last couple of centuries. Even highly educated men had the most circumscribed ideas of geography and foreign countries. For most men, the world was still flat and limitless. The only systematic political philosophy was based on the experiences of minute city-states and took no thought of empires. Nobody knew anything of the origins of civilization. No one had speculated upon economics before that time. No one had worked out the reaction of one social class upon another. We're too apt to consider the career of Alexander as the crown of some process that had long been afoot, as the climax of a crescendo. In a sense, no doubt, it was that, but much more true is it that it wasn't so much an end as a beginning. It was the first revelation to the human imagination of the oneness of human affairs. The utmost reach of the thought of Greece before his time was of a Persian Empire Hellenized, a predominance in the world of Macedonians and Greeks. But before Alexander was dead, and much more after he was dead, and there had been time to think him over, the conception of a world law and organization was a practicable and assimilable idea for the minds of men. For some generations, Alexander the Great was for mankind the symbol and embodiment of world order and world dominion. He became a fabulous being. His head, adorned with the divine symbols of the demigod Hercules or the god Amon-Ra, appears on the coins of such among his successors as could claim to be his heirs. Then the idea of world dominion was taken up by another great people, a people who for some centuries exhibited considerable political genius, the Romans, and the figure of another conspicuous adventurer, Caesar, eclipsed for the western half of the Old World the figure of Alexander. So, by the beginning of the 3rd century BC, we find already arisen in the Western civilization of the Old World three of the great structural ideas that rule the mind of contemporary mankind. We've already traced the escape of writing and knowledge from the secrets and mysteries and initiations of the Old World priesthoods, and the development of the idea of a universal knowledge, of a universally understandable and communicable history and philosophy. We've taken the figures of Herodotus and Aristotle as typical exponents of this first great idea, the idea of science, using the word science in its widest and properest sense, to include history and signify a clear vision of man in relation to the things about him. We've traced also the generalization of religion among the Babylonians, Jews, and other Semitic peoples, from the dark worship in temples and consecrated places of some local or tribal god to the open service of one universal God of righteousness, whose temple is the whole world. And now we've traced also the first germination of the idea of a world polity. The rest of the story of mankind is very largely the history of those three ideas of science, of a universal righteousness, and of a human commonweal, spreading out from the minds of the rare and exceptional persons and peoples in which they first originated into the general consciousness of the race, and giving first a new colour, then a new spirit, and then a new direction to human affairs.